Bartlett, Reel 2. Did you go to school?
Yes, I went to private school. All education for European children was private in those days. There was a state system of sorts for local people. Chinese people tended to run their own schools. The Malays attended what one might call village schools, I think. But there was quite a lot of illiteracy, and especially among the sort of Chinese servant, the kind of Chinese servants who worked, for example, in my parents' household. Quite a lot of them, when they came to work for my mother, couldn't read or write. My mother was a socialist, I think one might say. What's the word I'm looking for? She was a socialist in the sense that she felt that it was not right that people should be kept in ignorance and illiterate and be kept illiterate and stay illiterate. She taught them all to read and write, yes. And she taught them to speak English as well, which many of them couldn't do when they came to us. This was quite common, actually.
And after your initial, you know, sort of worry about the differences, did you become friendly with the servants, you know, the different ethnic people?
Yes. In the last house we occupied, the house we were in when we left, I'll come back to the business of school in a moment, if I may. My parents employed in the region of a dozen people, I think rather more than that, because some of them came part-time during the week. So it might have been a total of as many as about 15. But then there were five of us, because there were my parents and myself and my elder sister, who I mentioned already. And then my second sister was born there, 1938. So there were five of us. And the climate is very humid and not very tropical, and most European women used to find it very debilitating to have to do a lot of heavy housework. So virtually everybody employed local people. They had a variety of people in the household. The majority of the housemaids were Chinese. We had a Chinese cook and his assistant, and then we had a Malay driver and his wife and child. The Chinese tended to, I'll come to it in a moment, that we had two Tamil gardeners, and we had a Sikh, what he was called a jagger, a man who looked after the house at night. So we had all those ethnic differences, and at least half a dozen religions. My parents were Christian, so were, I think, two of the Chinese housemaids. The Tamils, I'm not sure what they are. They're a version of Hinduism, I think. The Malay was a Muslim, of course, and his wife. The Sikh, they're again. Is it a branch of Hinduism, isn't it? Some of the Chinese servants were Confucians. One was a communist, which is a secular religion, in my view anyway. So we had at least half a dozen religions. And among the Chinese, I would say probably at least four dialects. And one of the reasons why my mother taught them all English was because they couldn't understand one another within the house. This was the astonishing thing. They were all Chinese, but they couldn't understand one another. So she taught them English for that reason, really. It was a practical thing. Initially, anyway.
And your own education, Who were you being educated by? Who were your teachers?
I went to a private school called King's School, Singapore. And I still have one or two mementos of that, even now. I got the little brass name tag that we used to have to fit to our shirt front. It says Derek Bartlett, King's School, Singapore. Still got that. And that was a school for children up to the age of 12. And it was a day school. I went there, just there's no borders. And the Malay driver, the SICE, as you know, S-Y-C-E in Malay, he used to take me every day. And my mother was, my father was horrified years later when I was an adult. And I said, after we left the house, he'd stop and let me sit on his lap and steer the car, you see. And my father was horrified when he learned. But we used to do that every day. I learned to drive at the age of about 5. So he would take me there and bring me back every day. And it was a school that was based very much on English lines. All of the schools there were based on English. I suppose one could say public school and prep school lines, really. And I went there for most of the time I was in Singapore. But going back, if I may, just for a moment to the household, the domestic situation, we had the Chinese servants living in what one might call a compound at the back of the house. And the Chinese girls used to have their families living in the Chinese quarter of Singapore, but they would sleep in our house during their duty times, and then they would pop home, you know, for an afternoon when they were off, or a day perhaps. And my Alma, we all had personal servants. My parents had each had a personal servant. I had one, and so did my two sisters. And my Alma was a very young girl. She used to take me down to her mother's place in Singapore. Now that was in the Chinese quarter where the Chinese used to live. This was one of the things that always angered my mother about Singapore at that time, was that there was a very great deal of poverty particularly among the Chinese people. And they lived crowded, they lived in very crowded conditions in what are known as shop houses. There was a shop. So many of them ran shops. And then above the shop, there was the accommodation. And even today in Singapore, I was back there 2 years ago, and many of those places still exist, except that they're not, of course, occupied in the way they were. And a whole family of perhaps as many as 15 people would be crowded into one of these properties, you see. And most of the time, they lived out on the pavement. So my aunt would take me down to see her mother. And that's when I came into contact with lots of little Chinese boys. And we used to play there, outside the shop, on the street. My mother, of course, didn't know this. My armour was strictly forbidden when she took me out for a walk, which she did every morning before school. She was strictly forbidden to take me down to her own home, but she used to take me nevertheless. She and I had an agreement. We would not tell anybody. No. So this was really where I came into contact with Chinese children. It wasn't the only set of circumstances in which I did, but it was one of the most frequent. And I got on with them very well. Children get on with one another, you know. So they couldn't speak a lot of English. In most cases, I couldn't speak any Chinese, really. But nevertheless, we got on. Played the same games, you know. They taught me some Chinese games. I taught them cricket. So that was the sort of pattern of it, really. My father was able to earn a much better income. We had a much better standard of living there than we could ever, they could ever have had in this country at that time. I suppose one might say that they had the sort of standard of living that is taken for granted in a country like this now.
You were saying he worked for the Air Ministry.
Yeah.
But was he in the RAF? Was this sort of an RAF base?
Or? Yes, there was an RAF base at a place called Salita in Singapore. He was employed there for a long time. And he used to get in the car and drive out there every day. Because we lived in a place called River Valley Road, which is just above Orchard Road. So we were very close to the centre of the city. He used to have to drive to Salita, which is on the northeast side of Singapore Island. It's quite a long drive, actually, every day. But he was a civilian employed by the Royal Air Force establishment there as an engineer. But as far as I remember him saying, the people who were employed there, such as he was, were often employed to assist the colonial government in building infrastructure. So that, for example, if the colonial government decided they needed a reservoir, well, the engineers were already there. So he got involved in quite a lot of civil, what one might call civilian work. Housing, a whole series of things like that. He was also involved in building the installations for those guns which were notoriously facing the wrong way. And I discovered later, I have a book by Lieutenant General A.E. Percival, who was the officer commanding Singapore at the time of the surrender. And I had frequently wondered who gave the order for those guns to be placed in that position. And I gather from that book that it was he who did.
Who?
Lieutenant General Percival.
Oh, yes, not your father.
No. Well, no, my father was actually involved in building.
Yes.
He was given the job. He was the engineer in charge. Yeah. And he said to me years after the war that he was horrified at having to do this, because he felt that they were entirely in the wrong place. He said they should have been on the north side of the island, facing across the strait. That was the general feeling among Europeans there, that, you know, what were these guns doing on the south part of the island? They built one of the installations very close to a place called the Singapore Swimming Club, of which my parents were members. We used to go there, I would think, probably four or five times a week. And as a boy, I can remember being at the swimming club and watching a contractor build one of these gun emplacements. Actually stood watching them do it. And remembered my father's dismay at having to do it. And of course it turned out to be one of the most disastrous decisions that was ever made.
Were you finding, you know, being so far away from Europe, that European events were sort of creeping up on you, you know, such as this sort of worry about increasing the defences of the area? And was there the, you know, a feeling that war might be approaching as the 30s, you know, went on?
Yes. I think one should say, first of all, that children in those places in those days tended to be treated rather differently from the way they would have been treated here. We had more freedom in many ways. I mean, as children we were handed over to our armours, and my mother had a very busy social round going on. Virtually all women did there. She did involve herself in a certain amount of the word charitable work for the local people and so on. But she had quite a big household to run, three children. Keeping control of that number of domestic servants is actually quite a full-time job. It's surprising how much it involves. There were little quarrels and disputes. I remember particularly that the Chinese. We didn't have a butler as such because the situation was rather different from this country. But the Chinese woman who was the head of the domestic staff, she would do only certain jobs. And she saw the Malays and Indians as below her in social status, you see. So she would do only so much. And this pecking order existed right the way down through the whole collection of them. The Malay would only drive the car and keep the car washed and cleaned and in order. He would do nothing else. He wouldn't do anything else at all. No domestic work of any kind, nor would his wife. The Hindus would do only certain jobs. And of course there were inevitable clashes from time to time, which my mother had to sort out. This was a common thing. And all in different languages, talking to one another and not understanding a word, you know, unless they spoke English.
Were you getting news from, you know, were you aware of the European world as
yes.
Well,
yes, and this is why I was saying that the children were treated differently, because first of all I gradually became aware of this hierarchy and the status of different individuals within it, you see, and their attitudes and beliefs. Like, for example, I was in the car alone with my Chinese armour one day, and we were driving past the European St Andrew's Cathedral in Singapore, where I was christened. And I said to her, "Jesus is God." And she said, "Not for me." And that was the first time I was aware that not everybody was a Christian. So we had a degree of freedom, which we and certainly an exposure to extraordinary variety of different experiences, which we would not have, most certainly not have had here. And then to answer your question, yes, I was becoming aware of it at the age of about 8, I think, because, as I think you probably know, the Japanese, excuse me, Japanese invasion of China began in the early 30s. And then there was that terrible atrocity in Nanking when they murdered, what was it, something about 500,000 people in about 4 months. And that sent alarm bells ringing right through Southeast Asia. I don't think there's any question about that, looking back on it now. I used to hear my parents talking in rather anxious terms at the breakfast table. Adults do this, and they used to do it in those days. I think they thought we were completely deaf or didn't understand a thing. And they would discuss these things in front of me, you see. I was just completely ignored. And what I learned as quite a young child, actually, is that if I sat and kept quiet, I could learn quite a lot. And I remember sitting, listening to my parents with some friends one Sunday morning around the table. And my father was very agitated about the situation by then. And he was saying that he thought that there might be a Japanese invasion of Southeast Asia eventually, you see. And I quite distinctly remember sitting listening to this. And one of the women who was a guest there at that time, that morning, said to my father, "The little yellow men attack us, the British Empire. Surely not." And years later, when I was an adult, I was talking to my father about it after the war. And he said to me, "Do you know what killed us in Singapore and elsewhere? Complacency." He said they were so complacent, they thought no one would dare to attack us. And I remembered that. I couldn't have been more than about 8, and I remember sitting there listening to that. Not worrying about it, because it's not the sort of thing that children worry about. But at the same time, for example, my parents, like most Europeans, they took the Straits Times, the local paper, which was based on the Times. It even had the same sort of banner at the top. And there used to be these articles with the subheadings, you know, Japanese attack, Nanking, or whatever. And I can remember reading it, not really understanding the full implication of it, but nevertheless seeing it in the newspaper. I think by the time I was about 8, I was beginning to be a little bit concerned myself. Just listening to the adults talking, you know. And they were obviously worried. And if the adults, if your parents are worrying about something, it tends to trickle down onto you. And I do remember that, certainly. I think that was where anxiety began in my life. And of course the Chinese people in our household were horrified at what had happened in Nanking, because they often had relatives there, you see. Not all of them were what we called Straits Chinese. Some of them were, the Straits Chinese were born in the Malay Federation, including Singapore. But many, of course, had come from China itself. And they had relatives in Nanking, Hong Kong. And it did create quite a stir among them.
Yes, I suppose you were getting a very early indication of the nature of the Japanese, you know, the of military. Yes, it's often forgotten, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because I suppose Europe was that much farther away from Nanking and the Shanghai, and you know, that what happened from 1937.
It was all something that people saw in the newspapers, you know, whereas we were much more conscious of it, especially because there were so many Japanese shopkeepers and businessmen in Singapore at the time. And they weren't popular among the local people at all. We later learned, of course, that many of them were spies.
Did they keep very apart from the others, the Japanese?
We used to patronise their shop sometimes. If they had something my mother wanted, she would go into a Japanese shop and buy it. I remember going into a Japanese shop on several occasions with her. But they weren't liked.
And there was evidence, was there, later, that they were spies?
If Lieutenant General Percival's book is to be believed, they were definitely identified as sleepers, as we call them these days. Yes, they were.
When the events of 1938 and 1939, you know, the war in Europe started, did that make much of an impact where you were? You know, the invasion of Poland and the declaration on Germany.
I wasn't personally aware of that at that age, in the sense that one would be as an adult. But I do remember the anxiety of my parents because of their relatives living in Plumstead and Bexley Heath and so on, you see. And not getting letters quite so regularly because of the air raids once they'd started. And my mother became very anxious indeed about her parents. And she had two brothers, and they both lived in Plumstead then. And I do remember the general anxiety, really. Now, it was by that time I'd gone from a day school to boarding school. And the reason I went to boarding school will probably make you smile. My armour was charged with bathing me every day after school. So I came back from school and I had to have a bath. They had a shower, but my mother preferred the bath. And many years after the war, I was talking to her about this. And she said, I came into the bathroom because I told Arma that you were to have your bath. And she said, it seemed to take a long time. And she said, I decided to go upstairs and find out what was going on. And she said, I walked into the bathroom, and there you were, lying in a bath of water, with your legs over the side and your arms over the side. And there was a Chinese woman washing your left arm, and a Chinese woman washing your right arm. And there was a Chinese woman washing your left leg, and a Chinese woman washing your right leg. And there you were, enjoying it no end. And she said, I stood there and I thought, the Emperor of China can't be this pampered. And I was at boarding school about a month later, where Matron, who was a former member of the Queen Alexandra's Royal Army Nursing Corps, had a rather different approach. I was told that within 10 minutes I had to be in the bath, washed, cleaned, out. There was a bathroom with six baths in it and two armors, two Chinese armors, who would help us towel ourselves down, you see. Had to clean your teeth and be ready to say your prayers by the bedside in 10 minutes. And woe betide anyone who wasn't ready. It just could not have been more different, no.
Bit of a shock, I would think, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
The little emperor.
Well, you know, my armour, I mean, God bless her, when I took my clothes, I'd drop them on the floor, you see. She would scurry around and pick them all up. I never had to do anything at all. My mother said to me after the war, when I was an adult, we used to talk a lot about it, of course, inevitably one does that sort of thing. And she said to me, I was never really happy with it because I felt that it wasn't good for a child, that actually. And she said it was that spectacle, you know, coming into the bathroom and seeing that. And she said, I wondered how long it had been going on, you see. And she said it was really that decided me, that this had got to stop. But I don't know, you see, as a child I just took it all for granted.
Yes, I suppose it's normal, isn't it? What is happening every day is the commonplace.
Yes. One thing my parents did do, because again, my mother's attitude was very admirable in many ways. She had to employ those people, but she insisted that some of them were illiterate, they didn't speak very good English and so on. But she insisted, and so did my father, that they be treated with respect. And that was instilled in us from a very early age. If she saw us or heard us doing anything to humiliate them, you know what children are like. I mean, we didn't deliberately do it, but you get become a bit bossy. We very, very quickly were snapped on. Because she used to say to us, so these people are human beings, they're like us, they're here, they're doing a job. You know, her job is to look after you, but you treat her properly.
Yes, I would imagine it would be very easy to become, have a superior, arrogant attitude, yes. Which I suppose a lot of you
some people did. I'm sorry to have to say. And one thing I always admired my parents for, particularly my father, was that he had an attitude which was consistent no matter who he was dealing with. And I remember once he took me to, he and I used to go out, he used to take me out, just the two of us, on weekends. If my mother didn't want to go, he would take me. And we went across the causeway to the palace of the Sultan of Johor. Now, the Sultan of Johor was the, I think I'm correct in saying, paramount chief, as it were, of all in the whole peninsula, because Malaya then was the Federation of Malay States, and each state had its own sultan. It's a Muslim country, of course. And the Sultan of Johor was, from my memory anyway, he was the paramount sultan in that place. Part of his home was actually open to Europeans, not to the locals. And my father took me into this wonderful room. It was a banqueting hall where all the equipment that was needed to serve about 50 or 60 people was displayed on shelves along the side. And it was the finest English china and gold jugs and bowls and all kinds of things. There must have been a fortune in crockery and cutlery and so on there. And we were looking around, and then we came out, and the Sultan came out of his private apartments and down the stairs. And my father, he spoke to my father. They spoke just briefly for a minute or two. He could speak impeccable English. And my father's attitude to him, or perhaps I should put it the other way around, my father's attitude to his servants was precisely the same as it was to the Sultan. He didn't bow and scrape to the Sultan and bully his servants. He had exactly the same polite attitude, polite interest.
Derek Bartlett, End of Reel 2.